the ship of the damned still sails, and the long march. A shipload of refugees was turned away from the American shores, with no country willing to give them sanctuary. The ship was forced to return to its home port. What awaited those passengers was death in concentration camps. The year was 1939. The country, if you have not guessed by now, was Hitler's Germany, and the passengers were Jews. In 1971, similar camps awaited the Urdu-speaking minorities upon the creation of Bangladesh. Today, there are still 66 camps where 300,000 men, women, and children are confined. Those camps are rationalized in the same way the Nazi regime justified the camps of Europe. But the parallel between the Jews of World War II Europe and the Biharis of Bangladesh does not stop there. Both were minority groups labeled as traitors, accused of being privileged, and used as scapegoats. Both became targets of mob mentality that was whipped up by their leaders. The very name Bangladesh, roughly translated into English, is Bengali Nation and conjures up the same image as Hitler's Aryan Nation, with its basis of racial purity and nationalism as a central theme. And in both cases, the world closed its eyes on the plight of the victims. After India's successful invasion created Bangladesh, thousands of Biharis fled across the border seeking sanctuary in Burma. The Burmese at first accommodated them under the assumption that Pakistan would repatriate them. For a brief time, they flooded into camps set up for temporary asylum, and the Pakistan embassy began to process them for repatriation. Those with ties, family or sponsors in the West Wing, or central government employees were indeed transported to Pakistan. Those who had enough funds with them to pay their own airfare also had no problems in getting processed for transfer to Pakistan. But the bulk had no such ties in West Pakistan and had fled with hardly more than the clothes on their backs. For a short while, the Pakistan mission began to process them as hardship cases, but then as the numbers began to swell and the camps began to grow to overflowing, the government suddenly reversed itself and halted repatriation of all those with no means to get there on their own, with no connections in the West Wing. The Burmese government then faced the prospects of caring permanently for tens of thousands, with more each day continuing to come in, sent the army to seal off its borders and halt any further entry. Those still attempting to reach Burma were intercepted by the troops, were forced back across the border, where Mukti Bahini and Bangladesh soldiers lay in wait and slaughtered them. But there were still thousands in the camps that were now stateless, that Burma neither wanted to absorb or be responsible for. To their thinking, that would only encourage a continued influx of refugees. The Burmese then attempted to clear the camps by force, marching the refugees back to Bangladesh. But the Biharis resisted, many even asking to be shot rather than face what awaited them across the border. The Burmese then offered an alternative. If the Biharis would go without resistance, they would provide them with boats and they could make their way to another country. So thousands of men, women, and children were set afloat in the Bay of Bengal on sampans with scant provisions, where they were expected to land after they were cast into the bay became a moot question when a typhoon struck just hours after the flimsy boats were launched. While the exact number on those boats will never be known, hundreds of bodies were counted washing up on the shores of Sri Lanka and southern India. A few survivors were picked up in the Andaman Sea by fishermen. Under the Simla Agreement, the tripartite accords provided for the exchange of populations. But while all Bengalis who wanted to leave Pakistan were back in Bangladesh by 1974, Pakistan only accepted those Biharis who could get there on their own or with help from family or friends, and only repatriated those at government expense who were central government employees or who had a spouse or reunited minor children with their parents. There were provisions for what was called certain hardship cases as well. On the other hand, considering that applied to almost everyone, only a few managed to get repatriated under that criteria. The Bhutto regime, however, did give full rights of citizenship to those who, in one way or another, managed to get inside its borders. And for those who managed to make their way to neutral countries such as Nepal, Sri Lanka, or the Gulf states, they were able to get passports and enter Pakistan as citizens. Those who had Bangladesh citizenship were able to use those passports to enter the country and then reinstate their Pakistani citizenship. In 1977, after long years of negotiations with Lord Ennals and Dr. Sharif, Bhutto finally, though begrudgingly, agreed to begin repatriation of the remaining 470,000, provided it would not be at the expense of the Pakistan government. Funds for transport and resettlement were also arranged by Sharif and Ennals. Ships were chartered, and by July, 169,000 had been brought to Pakistan, with another shipload of as many as 2,000 was on its way. But on July 5, 1977, Prime Minister Zulfikar Ali Bhutto was deposed in a military coup. The following day, the chartered ship loaded with Bihari refugees reached Karachi, but was refused permission from the port authorities to allow the passengers to disembark. The ship was ordered to anchor offshore to await a decision on the policy of repatriation by General Ziaul Haq, who, after placing Bhutto under arrest, now established control of the government. For a week, that overcrowded ship remained outside the harbor. Food and water had run out. Sanitary conditions had deteriorated and dysentery raged. No food, medicine, or relief supplies were brought to the waiting ship. Then word from the government came. The captain was ordered to return the passengers to Bangladesh. The official policy of the military regime was that the terms of the Simla Accords had already been fulfilled and Pakistan was under no obligation to accept any more refugees from Bangladesh. But the Biharis, not accepted as Bangladesh nationals, would be barred from entry even if the ship returned to Chittagong, nor was there a country in the region willing to accept these passengers. Sometime around midnight of July 12, 1977, the refugees were ordered to jump or were thrown overboard. Many were small children and women. Many could not swim. The ship then departed. The sun rose that morning, and I went to the scene and saw for myself the horror of bodies floating in the harbor. For weeks afterwards, fishermen were recovering bodies washed out to sea or on to the shores of the coast. The few survivors who made it to land became the first of what became the illegal population. Now let me tell you about the Long March. Not the one in China during 1948, but the one that took place in Bangladesh during August of 1979. You never heard of it? Well, you are not alone. By 1979, the stranded Pakistanis found no relief. They were still confined to the camps. General Ziaur Rahman had taken over the country in a military coup after the assassination of Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, and his Bihari policy was as oppressive as the previous regime. In Pakistan, General Ziaul Haq had executed Bhutto and was now firmly in control and kept the door not only closed but locked to repatriation. The Biharis, in an act of desperation, decided to repatriate themselves and march across the country through India to Pakistan. 100,000 swarmed out of the camps and on August 12th made it as far as Dinajpur, 11 miles from the Indian border. As they made camp near the river Kamchor, the plan was to begin the mass crossing into Indian border on August 14th, Pakistan's Independence Day. But at midnight, the Bangladesh army surrounded their encampment and began firing on them. They continued the non-stop shooting until dawn. In the morning, the survivors were rounded up and forced to throw the dead into the river. The wounded and those who dropped from exhaustion were shot. "The river ran red with blood," said Muhammad Sukhruddin, a survivor of the long march. Now in his 60s, he is still in Geneva camp. "The river was clogged with bodies. Then the soldiers forced marched us, without food or water, back to the camps." During the grueling trek, Sukhruddin told of holding his head back and opening his mouth to get water when it started to rain. "We were ordered to run or trot most of the way, while the soldiers prodded us on from their jeeps. Those who slowed down, fell, or collapsed were shot. By the time they reached the camps, only 40,000 had survived the entire ordeal. Or to put it another way, 60,000 perished during the long march." After many more years passed, another military man, General Hussein Irshad, took over Bangladesh. Following the assassination of Ziaur Rahman, later, Irshad stepped down from power in disgrace, and after rocky elections, Khaled al-Rahman then took the shaky reins of governance. Notwithstanding a change in government, whatever its form has brought no changes in the camps. 1,100 miles away, Ziaul-Huq's iron rule ended in a fiery airplane explosion. His successor, Benazir Bhutto, abandoned the Biharis to their fate as he had done. After her regime was brought down, came Nawaz Sharif. Just when Sharif decided to reopen the long-closed door to repatriation, he was removed. New election then returned Benazir Bhutto, who not only closed and locked the door again, but nailed it shut. By this time, the desperation of those in the camps had reached a terminal state, and there was constant talk of mass hunger strikes and, God forbid, even another long march. In another era, the world had closed its eyes, and only after 6 million Jews perished do we now hear countless stories of the Holocaust. Much too late for the 6 million, but certainly it should serve as a lesson of what can happen when a people are allowed to be persecuted with impunity. Yet, from 1971 to the present, the plight of the Bihari leaves serious doubts that we have really learned the lessons of the past. The fact that a people who, because of the language they speak, have been allowed to languish in camps and have found no shores in the world offering sanctuary and no protests about their plight must mean we have not learned a thing. Bangladesh could not isolate or deprive a minority group of basic human rights if there was a world voice out there protesting. The Biharis would not have been marooned in that hostile land if there was a world out there to put pressure on the Pakistan government to fulfill her moral obligations. Allowing this to go on is not only condemning 300,000 men, women, and children, but other potential victims in some other part of the world. When some government decides they speak the wrong language, are the wrong color, practice the wrong religion, and decides it can get away with oppressing another minority population without interference. Indeed, perhaps, Bangladesh did pave the way for ethnic cleansing in Bosnia, Chechnya, and Rwanda. Are we doomed to repeat the same journey on ships that land only on death's shores? There might even be a ship bound for nowhere, with a berth waiting in it for you and me.